The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Angela Nagle is a writer based in Ireland. Her work has appeared in the Irish Times, the Dublin Review of Books, and the Atlantic. Her recent article, The New Man of 4chan, was written for The Baffler and was the basis for a book coming out from Zero Books next year, tentatively titled Kill All Normies, The Online Culture Wars from 4chan to Trump. We'll be discussing her book and her research on this episode of Zero Squared. It's Wednesday, November 23rd, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Now, before we get to the interview, I want to make a correction. Last week, I said that Trump had selected Breitbart's Steve Bannon to be his chief of staff, but what I should have said was that Trump had selected Bannon as chief strategist. Those are very different positions and shouldn't be conflated. Also, I wanted to pause here to mention that many people contacted me to say they were unhappy with my interview with Rechtenwald. The thought was that I'd gone too soft on him. Now, I haven't heard from Rechtenwald since I posted the interview, but I bet that he wouldn't share that view. Anyhow, some people wrote to me because I seemed to agree with Rechtenwald too readily in the actual interview. So here's one letter I received from a listener. Dear Douglas, I'm a listener from San Francisco and a serious fan of Zero Books and Zero Squared. Thanks for that. But I'm writing to you in response to your most recent episode of Zero Squared, number 89, Deplorables, which I found to be far below your standards as a thinker and as a cultural producer. I found two things about this episode deeply troubling. First, a week after history's most successful internet troll was elected to the U.S. presidency, you had on your show an internet troll and agreed with nearly everything he said, and took him to task for nothing. Secondly, despite your admittedly knowing little about trans issues, you spent the episode opining on them. You even say something to the effect of, "Don't trans people just want to switch pronouns? This is such a baffling, ignorant view on trans people that I was shocked you said it." Then it occurred to me that despite Zero being far-reaching and thorough in its politics, I'm unable to find an instance of any trans issues being covered in its pages or podcasts from any point of view other than opposition. I find you to be a knowledgeable seeker, and I deeply encourage you to fix this gaping hole in your knowledge. So I'm going to stop there. There's more to the letter. This is a fine letter. You know, I think that there were some things in the letter that were unfair or not true. Like, it's not true that I didn't challenge Rechtenwald on anything. Certainly in the introduction I did, and I think I asked him some questions that were maybe a little uncomfortable. But I did largely agree with what he was doing at the moment I interviewed him. So here's my response to that letter. Thanks for writing. I want to respond to two points that you raised. First, you mentioned my comment that transgender seems different than gender fluidity, or that a trans person wouldn't have the same issues around pronouns that a gender fluid person would have. That was my opinion, that these things are different, that a trans person would be moving from one pronoun, say he or she, to the other. Now, that comment didn't come from total ignorance. What I take issue with is the trans part of the word transgender, because I associate that prefix with the word transsexual. According to Medical Daily, a transsexual is somebody who transitions from one sex to another. While technically the word transgender is perfectly logical to me if it means gender fluid, because it can be read to mean transcending gender, the implication is that transgender people have the same difficulties, for instance, suffer from the same social stigmas as strictly transsexual people. And that's just not true. Just as a case in point, last night I spoke at Portland State University. Actually, it was not last night, it was a few days ago. I spoke at the invitation of someone who, once I met them, informed me that they wondered or felt that they might be gender fluid. This person didn't actually insist that I use the pronouns I've been using, this they pronoun. It was very cordial. Point is, though, that this gender fluid person presented as a male, accepted the male pronoun, at first anyway, and was straight in his sexual orientation, or in their sexual orientation. They were also very sincere in feeling like the label of man or male wasn't a perfect fit. They felt that they didn't really fully identify as male. Now, with this as a criteria for being transgender, then I'm transgender too, because I don't feel particularly male all the time, or I certainly don't feel like I'm a real man or a man's man. It's not a perfect fit for me either. So if I'm, you know, transgender, so be it. People can refer to me by a gender-neutral pronoun. That's fine. But I just don't think that my gender fluidity, because I don't feel like the perfect embodiment of a man, or that I even know exactly what it is to be a real man, that gender fluidity that I could claim, it just isn't the same as the kind of issues with gender that a transsexual person would have. Because if I was a transsexual, I wouldn't feel out of place in relationship to a social construction called gender, but to my body, to my own body. So as a possibly gender-fluid person myself, I don't feel comfortable claiming the experience of a transsexual person. Also, another point is that Rechtenwald didn't go on Twitter to troll anyone. He didn't talk to anyone who was on the left while he was on Twitter under his pseudonym. If you listen to the interview again, he makes that clear. He went on Twitter as a member of the alt-right, talking to the alt-right. I don't really know what reason when I look back on it. Now, I hope that this response doesn't offend anyone. It didn't offend the listener who wrote in. The listener got an email that was similar to what I just said. Now, I want to make a separate comment on something else. Namely, that a white supremacist named Richard Spencer has been in the news. He's been associated with Steve Bannon and Breitbart. And he's been getting a lot of publicity around the election of Trump. Now, what I found most noteworthy about Spencer's speech, other than the obvious allusions to Hitler and Nazism with the Hail Trump salutes, was something that he said about what race was and about or what his position is on race. And I was reminded listening to Spencer talk of a conversation I had at Occupy Portland 5 years ago. It was a conversation that was supposed to be about class relations, and I said that I was, you know, railing on about how class was best understood as something other than an identity, and that while issues around race, gender, and other identities were significant, that class really needed to be thought of as an economic force, and as the economic force that drove and shaped the world. That class relation and around capital and capitalism. So most everyone at Occupy Portland disagreed with me in that little group I was in. I was told that I had it backwards. Culture and identity were the foundation of the world for the people at Occupy, and economic realities were merely contrivances and appearances, according to them. Now, Spencer, this guy, this Nazi, he would agree with that assessment. And if you want to know what most of the left has in common with the alt-right, that's it. It's this belief that tribal identity is the most significant force operating in the world. The truth is quite the opposite. Karl Marx says it best. The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production, and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all previous, earlier industrial classes. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast-frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind. What this means is that those old tribal identities were not founded on ideas alone, but were based on ways of life, ways of organizing work and distributing products. And now capitalism has pushed those old forms away. It hasn't done so in the name of European values. It hasn't done so for Africa. It hasn't done so in order that Pepe the Frog might stride across the earth or in order to produce the first woman president. It has done so because it is driven to do so by its own internal logic and contradictions. And if there's anything good about capitalism, anything great about it, it is the fact that it has liberated us from these old ways of life, brought us together in our work, and driven us to innovate. There's a lot that is bad about capitalism, but this is what's good about it. And Richard Spencer is wrong. He doesn't know how the world works or what's happening. He's deluded. He's not only a racist. He's deluded. Okay, so now that's cleared up. Let me warn listeners that Angela Nagel's interview is on a similar theme as Rechtenwald's interview. However, Angela Nagel is a feminist and a journalist who's been studying the alt-right for quite some time. And I hope that listeners will find a way past being offended, or if you are offended, to engage with what's said. Write in. Let me know what you think. Also, consider joining the Zero Books Club. This week's members-only Inside Zero Books podcast will be the second hour of my conversation with Angela Nagel. Right now, you're listening to an instrumental version of Edward Hill's famous Trollolo song, but I'm not trolling. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Angela Nagel and I discuss the rise of the alt-right. The way I think of the culture war that's been going on, and that I think of it starting with Gamergate, but which probably started well before that, is that it's a war between Tumblr and 4chan.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are kind of the two spaces that have been most important. I mean, I've been looking at this for about 8 years. I actually wrote my PhD thesis on online anti-feminist movements. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of been watching this, and obviously there's a big alt-right overlap there. And, you know, I definitely think, although if you say this, the response is always sort of that you are in some way blaming or victim blaming. But I do think that the right and left wings of the online culture wars exists very much in relationship to each other, in a kind of dialectical relationship with each other. They're constantly referencing each other. They're constantly, you know, kind of reacting to each other. So I think, for example, big things that have kind of bubbled up into mainstream coverage, like Gamergate, or even like, say, the campus wars over safe spaces and trigger warnings and all that. If you're paying close attention to these kind of spaces, what's going on online, you can see that actually these things have been developing for years.
I'll just confess, for a little while, I kind of fell into the anti-feminist rabbit hole. Like, if you look at my YouTube history, like I've watched Sargon of Akkad.
Me too.
And I would let myself get upset or angry about some of the extreme things that I saw, or unjustifiable things I saw going on in the name of feminism. But it became clear to me that the reaction, that When I watched the Gamergate fiasco unfold, it became clear to me that the anti-feminist side was actually a very, very frightening side, that they were picking up old kind of red-baiting far-right ideology and using, I don't know, triggered tumblers as an excuse to push very reactionary ideas.
We're dealing with so many different kind of layers of this happening. And one of the things that I think has become very obvious is that because all of this stuff is so steeped in irony, this kind of really detached, ironic tone, it's very hard to know what anyone actually means. I don't think the people themselves really know what they mean. So, for example, you know, when you see a swastika being used by the alt-right, if you take that literally, this person's a fascist, they'll laugh at you because, you know, you don't get it, like you don't sort of get internet subcultures. But in actual fact, we see that there is a big overlap between people who actually really do mean it and the people who are being ironic. And in the case of something like Gamergate, I think it's very interesting that Ben Shapiro and Kathy Young both kind of saw the really nasty undercurrent in, you know, kind of in their own, roughly their own political sphere. And both of them have been attacked, you know, for being Jews and for being critics of that. So we're dealing with, you know, we're trying to develop a political language in order to be able to refer to different sections of, you know, the online culture wars. But the fact that there's so much irony and kind of postmodern playfulness about it does make it a little bit hard to talk about. I mean, just to use an example from the other side, you would often see feminists from the kind of Tumblr world with misandrists in their Twitter bio. Now, again, if you say to them, is that actually, you know, is that actually how you would describe yourself? Of course, they would laugh at you and make fun of you, just as the alt-right would do if you took them seriously on any of what they say.
But what they say in both cases is, oh, you know, you special snowflake, did I offend you? Oh, let me drink your tears.
That kind of thing.
And it doesn't matter which side you're talking to. They both will say exactly that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. They have a similar kind of sensibility in some weird way. And in part, I suppose it's a kind of a defense mechanism, because the online world is so dangerous. If you say one wrong thing, your entire career can be destroyed overnight. Everyone knows that. So if you're hiding behind layers and layers of irony, or sort of faux irony, really, it is a way of protecting yourself from being easily interpreted. The French New Right used to sometimes be called the Gramscians of the right. And I think that's a really good expression for what we now call the alt-right. Because while liberals were in their own bubble talking about, you know, how many hundred genders there are, these guys were actually working really, really hard building alternative media. And if you go, for example, if you watch their stuff on YouTube, which is where I think they've really made massive progress, you will, as you say, go into a rabbit hole, because YouTube will start then recommending all their stuff to you. So I've been just in a rabbit hole of, you know, the rebel media and Lauren Southern and Gavin McInnes and Milo Yiannopoulos. And this is, you know, and these kind of cringe compilations that they make, social justice warrior cringe compilations and all that stuff. So I've been watching that for ages.
Okay, so what do you think of Gavin?
This is interesting. I was watching a show of Gavin's. First of all, he is very funny.
Yeah, he's like actually talented. He's like a talented comedian.
No, he's extremely funny.
Yeah.
But I was watching him the other day, and he had, I'm not sure exactly when the clip was from. It might be an old one, but it was Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer, who we saw saying, you know, hail Trump, and all the crowd were all big hailing. So he's one of the people who isn't being ironic, right? And Gavin MacInnes is kind of being ironic, I mean, in part. So Gavin MacInnes had him on, and they were getting along great, cracking jokes, making fun of social justice warriors. And then towards the end, Spencer started saying, you know, race is like the lake and civilization is like the mist. And then, you know, pretty much said outright, people who are not white need to leave. And Gavin kind of, you could see his face, and he was kind of, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said something along the lines of, right, but you don't really mean that, do you? He didn't actually get, I mean, I don't think he really got that Richard Spencer really does mean it.
But how could he not know that when I know it? You know, I'm not as deeply enmeshed in that world as he is, as Gavin is. He should know that Richard Spencer is for real. This is a real white supremacist deal.
How do you know what is for real when everyone is always, when, you know, their whole style, the whole kind of broader orbit of the alt-right is about trolling. Right. That's the whole 4chan kind of style, trolling. So the idea of trolling is that you're doing it, to get a reaction. It's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of a performance. And I don't know, when you're steeped in that world to such an extent and you have enemies in common that you hate so intensely, I think it is easy to not quite know. I mean, look, punks used to wear, you know, Susie Sue wore a swastika. And she did that at a time when, you know, you can imagine all the survivors of World War II in Britain were, you know, obviously heroes. And that was very much part of British identity. And it was such an incredibly intense taboo. You know, it was a very untouchable thing. So, I mean, was Susie Sue a Nazi? Like, no, we accept that, you know, these things can be done on the level of some kind of performance.
But nonetheless, I can tell that Richard Spencer is not just performing. And I think Gavin and Ben Shapiro, maybe, and others like him, are playing a very, very dangerous game with these guys. And they, obviously, because now it's come really home.
Give you another example. I've watched, I think, all of the Milo Yiannopoulos campus tour kind of videos. And at this point, you know, it seems like his opposition have completely given up, actually, if they even tried at any point actually debating him. So they're outside protesting. And the only videos that are going to appear of their protests, if any, are going to be ones where they look ridiculous. And the videos that emerge inside show, you know, Milo being actually very charismatic and very funny and having an audience that absolutely love him. But on occasion, you see, he does say things that you could only read as having some kind of a eugenics origin. So he'll say things like, you know, gays are a super race and that's why they need to breed because they have a higher IQ. And so, you know, he says we should go back to the good old days when gays used to have a family and they did all the fun stuff on the side. So that's funny, right? I mean, that is funny. But it does have, you know, it does suggest a certain view of IQ and breeding and so on. So I remember one time in one particular event, some guy in the audience, and I don't know where the guy was coming from politically, but he did ask him about it. He said to Milo, lots of things that you've said suggest that you, you know, you have this view of genetics and IQ. And Milo tried to brush it off with a joke and then said something like, oh, I don't really know. I'm not really sure. Now, that is it believable that he genuinely hasn't really thought about it? That he sees it as such, you know, just a pure rhetorical kind of performance? Or is it possible that he has thought about it and just doesn't want to come out and say it in a way that won't be insulated by layers of irony?
What do you think about the fact that Milo will constantly say, if you want to defeat me, then don't protest, don't scream and yell, debate me?
He's right. He's absolutely right. Listen, I've watched all these videos, and I think I've watched every single one of them, and I have yet to see a single young woman, an articulate feminist, or any other kind of liberal, stand up and actually put forward a coherent, strong, cogent argument and really challenge him. Isn't that amazing? I mean, think about what good propaganda that is for him. Now, when I say this to my left-wing friends, they say, well, you know, he's very, you know, he's a kind of a nasty character, and he's posh and he's privately educated, and, you know, it's sort of impossible to beat him. And I just think, where are we getting this from? Anyone listening to this should go back and look at the amazing town hall debates that went on between Jermaine Greer and Norman Mailer. A bunch of other people are there, Susan Sontag and various people. Back then, feminists were able to run rings around Norman Mailer, and he was really tough. They had really great
arguments. But Norman Mailer wasn't on the right, you know?
Sure, but regardless, I mean, what I'm saying is that what has changed within feminism that we now think that Milo, who isn't, you know, I mean, he's not like some kind of, you know, he's not even considered a sort of an intellectual. So we think that we don't have what it takes to actually go in, debate with Milo and win. I think that says a lot about the state of feminism right now.
Yeah. Is that really what it is? Feminists don't believe they can beat him in debate? I mean,
yes, because liberals and the left, I mean, we have to some extent include ourselves in this, have been kind of no platforming and, you know, really kind of just halo polishing and saying, I'm too pure to be on a platform with this person. That's, you know, what a great, feminist or anti-racist or whatever I am. All that time, the right have been sharpening their arguments, really toughening up and preparing for a real kind of battle. And we have become, you know, really just flabby and decadent and completely unable to actually argue our positions because, you know, we feel we're above actually having the debates in public. And I really think, I mean, I'm a free speech advocate, which is rare on the left, unfortunately, right now. But one of the reasons I am is that I think, especially in the age of the internet, if you want to make a political argument, you have to go out and debate people who disagree with you. You have to get it out there in the most public platform possible. You have to win, and you have to be seen to win in public. And that means actually arguing with these people.
You must die, not Mailer. Not Mailer. I don't want to kill Mailer, but I must kill Kingsley in this picture. Norman.
No, baby. You know, you trust me. You trust me. Come on.
I'll trust you if you trust me.
All right.
Promise.
All right.
Okay, I go. Okay. I'm sorry, Dad.
Oh, it's not easy to get up.
No. Let me hit you.
No.
No.
Hey! Will you cut this fucking idiot out?
It's worth noting from like an economic or socialist perspective that Lori Penny and Milo Yiannopoulos kind of come from the same place and they're on the same career trajectory and they're the same class, that they're not at odds with each other materially. In fact, their brands work well. There's synergy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Lori Penny wrote a piece about Milo, very much kind of placing herself as the kind of frenemy, right, of him. And it described how, you know, they sort of ran around a TV studio talking about boys and all this kind of stuff. Now, she was making a good point on one end, which was that she was basically trying to suggest that Milo is someone who doesn't really get that some people really earnestly mean everything they say, which I think is really interesting, because I'm very interested in how kind of irony works in these spaces. But certainly in terms of class, I mean, if you go through like all the big kind of British young up and coming kind of commentators, not only do they come from the same class, they did the same course in college, half of them, which is PPE. You know, they're very, they exist in a very similar world. You know, and all of that. But I think ultimately, I mean, I'm very much of the view, looking at all of this, that, you know, okay, there is a kind of vulgar materialist view, right? Which is something that I would have subscribed to in the past, seeing everything in that way. And definitely, the materialist perspective is one that is very useful and often absent. But I think ultimately, when it comes to actually winning, you know, or understanding how others have won, I think it is worth thinking about the fact that ideas actually really matter and arguments actually really matter. The content of the argument really matters. You know, I think, you know, so in other words, like, so we would think often, or people on the left would often say, you know, something like, you know, the reason that the left hasn't won historically is because all these material factors were stacked against them, or the media was, you know, against the media hegemony or the culture industry or whatever. But we've just witnessed somebody coming to power without any mainstream media support. Even the right was against him, right? You could fill a couple of libraries with the amount of writing that the left has dedicated to explaining why this was not possible. Why, if the dominant ideology of the media was against you, you know, you didn't have a chance. So I don't know. I really just increasingly think that we really have to focus on actually winning the argument.
Well, I agree we do have to win the arguments, but I don't know. See, I don't see that critique of the media as being a material critique. It's an ideological critique.
Mm.
Right, it's saying people are brainwashed. If the media says things, they believe it. Materially, if they have more organs of propaganda, they're going to beat us.
Mm.
But so what that leaves out is actually people thinking comes from their own material conditions. You can't just brainwash people. They kind of know what's going on.
Absolutely. One of the reasons, again, that I think the whole anti-free speech, no platform thing is misguided is I think it's absolutely brilliant propaganda for the alt-right. Their whole, I mean, right through from 4chan to kind of the entire alt-right and Trump, they have won in part because they have been able to kind of package themselves as anti-establishment rebels. And that's not completely made up, by the way. I mean, if you look at something like the attacks on Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn as brocialists, right, and that whole idea of Bernie bros, I mean, the liberal media does lie. Like, when the alt-right says that, they're correct. There is a liberal media establishment, and it does just produce clickbait for kind of liberal culture wars people. I mean, even in my limited experience of using Twitter, for example, which I've been on and left a couple of times, you know, if you share something that's like a thoughtful analysis or, you know, a beautiful piece of music or whatever, it'll be completely ignored. As soon as you wade into the culture wars, suddenly the retweets start to roll in, you know. And so there is something about the dynamics of Twitter and lots of social media platforms that does kind of encourage the constant ramping up of this stuff. But to go back to the materialist analysis, I mean, I was just reading something a moment ago. I hope you don't mind me reading out just a short paragraph of it. It was in The Atlantic. And it says, it was a piece in The Atlantic, and it says, according to an analysis by the economist Jed Kolko, counties with the most routine jobs, including manufacturing, so the ones that are the most susceptible to automation and offshoring, were by far the most likely to vote for Trump. In counties where less than 40% of the jobs are routine, Clinton won by more than 30 percentage points. In counties where more than 50% of jobs are routine, Trump won by more than 30 points. The concentration of routine jobs predicted Trump support far better than unemployment or income. It goes on to say there are seven occupations that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has predicted will add more than 250,000 new jobs in the next decade. And these are personal care aides, registered nurses, home health aides, and so on. Women account for more than 85% of these jobs, including personal care aides and so on. In other words, the fastest growing jobs in America are about as dominated by women as an occupation like building inspection or computer repair is dominated by men.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a material, a really good...
Personal story is an aside here. I'm 45. I'm, you know, writer and publisher. Always sort of, I've been a precariat my whole adult life. My wife now, because our kids are older, is going to nursing school. So very soon, I will no longer be the main breadwinner in the family. My wife will be, and she'll have the real professional job.
I think that makes you a cuck.
It does, right? I'm a total cuck.
There's a new word in town.
You know what they like to call people today? I've noticed cuck. It's like the kids on the internet have found a new insult.
You can hear it coming over the horizon like a swarm of angry geese. Cuck, 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 cuck.
Before we even get started, let's be clear. Doing a video on the word cuck is the most cuck thing in the world. I'm the cuckiest cuck this side of Cuckopolis. I know, I'm aware.
I mean, this is why the reindustrialization of America stuff made Trump so popular. And it was undoubtedly tied to the fact that he's sort of an alpha male. But Bernie also was pushing a kind of reindustrialization, slightly different, more green-tinged kind. But that kind of stuff. And I think that's also why he was popular. Now, in the midst of all that, I mean, given the figures that I just gave you, what is the left's response to that? Because, you know, I'm all for going to war on, you know, genuine misogynists. I mean, this is stuff I've been writing about for ages. But why is it that we on the left have accepted the kind of constant denigration of ordinary guys from pretty elite women? I mean, just to go back to the class thing that you were talking about, that should be totally unacceptable to us. So in response to the figures I gave you, I bet you if you posted that online, if you went on Twitter, a standard liberal feminist response that you would get would say, oh, well, you know, this explains why they're all reactionary and, you know, man babies and all that kind of stuff, you know, language of, like, mansplaining and manspreading and so on. So in other words, what they're basically saying is these guys are losing their jobs. They're losing their entire identity. They're losing their livelihoods and sort of, ha ha, what a bunch of, you know, man babies. I mean, that's an appalling way to speak. And it should be totally unacceptable on the left.
If you have a culture where the primary industry is nursing, that doesn't seem very sustainable to me.
I know. And yeah.
If we have a financial crisis again, or if we have another economic crisis, this is very bad news for everyone. It's
absolutely bad news for everyone, because if you look at the jobs, I mean, nursing, you know, is traditionally very unionized, very unionizable kind of job. But the other ones that are in there among the growth sectors are kind of, you know, people in the service sector, you know, very... not very heavily unionized, kind of very unstable, low paid jobs. Like, a lot of these jobs that are being created are not really very good jobs. I was looking up, there's 3.5 million employed in truck driving in America. Now, that's going to be replaced by driverless vehicles pretty soon, probably. I mean, just think of the scale of that. Like, I don't think we are anywhere near actually figuring out how we're going to deal with this. I've been, you know, I loved Bernie, and I've generally kind of been someone who, you know, loves kind of labor history and maybe sort of slightly fetishizes the big kind of, you know, the railway workers and all these kind of big industries that that led kind of really heroic labor struggles in the past. But, you know, we do have to somehow deal with this really imminent kind of problem, which is going to express itself on such a massive scale. I mean, think of, for example, in the case of the truck drivers.
Yeah.
Think of all the rural towns where small businesses make their money from that, you know, cargo kind of passing through. And, you know, I mean, it's just going to have such a huge effect. Now,
you know, but this isn't unique to this time. The automation has always led to economic crisis, and not just through unemployment, but just overall. And so, you know, I think that automation will have unintended consequences like the ones you're mentioning. And I also think that a nation that it primarily employs nurses is a weak nation economically. That can't,
yeah,
that can't be sustained. And it has nothing to do, you could have all male nurses and it still would be a weak nation.
Well, but I really don't know the answer to these things. And,
I know.
You know, I went to see Deirdre McCluskey was speaking in Ireland recently. And of course, she's a Milton Friedmanite.
Yeah.
And she opened by saying Bernie and Trump are both completely wrong in thinking that that the economy is ever going to go back to being productive in the way that it once was. And the whole kind of bring jobs home thing through protectionism is not going to work. And we have to face the fact that in the future, you know, work, there will be less work and it will be very different. And I'm not really putting forward any particular case there because it, honestly, it's beyond what I can really grasp non-economist.
Right.
But it's just what I'm thinking about at the moment. And I do think it has a massive, I think it is why Trump got elected, really. I mean, I think it's the single biggest reason. And it's very much connected to the role of men and the role of women. Because obviously, well, to some extent, I kind of agree with the Hannah Rosen end of men thesis. You know, I do think that that kind of masculinity that was that kind of it was perhaps traditional, but kind of survived through modernity and through the sexual revolution and so on by through industry, really, that came to an end. And I don't really know what kind of masculinity will look like afterwards.
Here's the thing. My understanding is that there is still quite a lot of production and factory work going on in the United States. We don't think about it too often, though, because it's done by immigrants to a large degree. And it's not union, and it's very low wage, and it's slave labor tucked away here and there in the United States. And certainly around the world, there's plenty of manufacturing going on. Again, it's slave labor in slave labor conditions, you know, in around the world.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about the loss of masculinity, you're actually not really, you know, the people making your iPad are likely women.
Yeah.
Living in barracks in China.
Yeah.
In horrible, horrible conditions. And those are the industrial working class of China.
Mm.
And so when you're talking about trying to do something about for working class people, that's who you're talking about, as much as you're talking about some laid off coal miner in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
It made me upset when people would use gender to go after Sanders for his economic positions when that really didn't make any sense. That what he was talking about was
No, of course not. And also, of course, he was very popular with women, particularly right. younger women.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I kind of said this already, but the Bernie Bro thing was, you know, had no basis in fact. But that didn't stop liberals from using it anyway. And they're going to keep doing that. I mean, I thought the outcome of this election was that Hillary would win. I thought one positive thing about that is that it would kind of realign the left a little bit and allow us to kind of make the break, make a complete break with those people, you know. Yeah. I've actually, I have to say, I was really impressed by a lot of the American commentary from the left after Trump was elected. Liza Featherstone wrote a great piece. Thomas Frank, Conor Kilpatrick from Jacobin is sort of a happy warrior on Twitter, fighting them all. And I was actually, you know, it was a rare moment where I actually felt quite proud to kind of be on that side of the argument. So I would like to see a complete break with kind of elite liberals who have absolutely nothing between their ears but culture, you know. Who have no kind of economic understanding of anything at all, and who really aren't our friends. I mean, they, you know, when it comes down to it, when we get even a sniff of power, I mean, they attack us even harder than the right does.
Right. But now, though, Clinton didn't win, and yeah. Trump's oh, yeah. coming in with this kind of, I mean, he's not a traditional right winger.
It's so interesting because in so many ways, like for years, the right has been, the right kind of establishment, which the alt-right hates, by the way, has been saying Keynesian capital investment in infrastructure is old hat. No, it'll make you unelectable. Nobody wants that anymore. Ripping up international trade agreements, you can't do that. It's not realistic, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it was only when Trump got elected that I realized that I've actually totally internalized that stuff, because even though rationally I don't agree with it, some part of me kind of did feel like, well, people don't really like that anymore. And so then Trump gets elected with this, you know, totally outrageous kind of behavior and proposing all these kinds of things that the neoliberals and the neocons hate. And, you know, he's got all this kind of anti-PC, alt-right baggage, and he still got in anyway. And he didn't have the mainstream media. He didn't have, you know, any of that stuff behind him. I mean, there is lots of stuff. But you know what's really interesting? BuzzFeed published a transcript of Stephen Bannon from Breitbart talking about... it was some kind of an interview with a Vatican body of some kind. And I guess they published it thinking, oh, this will make him look like a mad kind of conspiracy theorist. Actually, it makes him look like a really interesting person. I mean, not in a good way, but interesting nonetheless. If you read what he says, I mean, there's always been an anti-capitalist streak in the Catholic Church anyway. But he's talking about, he actually says, uses the phrase, the crisis of capitalism. He talks about individualism, you know, and he sees secularization as part of this. He's talking about, you know, really big term kind of stuff like Western civilizational decline and all that kind of stuff, you know, which is very familiar to me in a way. I mean, we don't talk about civilizational decline on the left, but we do tend to think in those kind of big epochal terms. Whereas I don't think liberals do at all. They kind of have this real presentism. They just think, you know, the sort of moral compass that we have this week is how it should always be. And so, yeah, I mean, one good thing, like one of the few good things to come out of this is, as I say, I think I kind of internalized a real end of history kind of sense of the world that I know people said that sort of ended with 9/11, but I actually think like I came of age in a time when there was kind of just a feeling in the air that there was this political center that couldn't be broken. And the right and left would sort of bicker over policy things, a little bit more tax, a little bit less tax. But basically there was a sensible kind of a center ground, and anyone outside of that was sort of mad and would never be voted in and would never be popular. Well, Trump has shown us that that's not the case. Whatever he might do, and he may turn out to be just another one of these people, but he didn't get elected on those grounds. He got elected by being a radical.
Right. Although I just want to point out that Keynesianism is no kind of radical politics.
Yeah, you know. Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I guess I mean, you know, it's a break from the absolute deadlock from what right. seemed like an unmovable kind of center.
As a wannabe Marxist, I don't think that approach will ultimately fix our crisis. Which you know, from 2008, I don't believe that will work. And I've got a book coming out from a guy named Michael Roberts on the world crisis and capitalism, where he goes over the declining rate of profit and, you know, a very Marxist analysis, and has empirical data that's coming out from Zero next year.
I don't think it will work either, by the way.
Yeah, right. But I know what you're talking about. And so, Do you think that the online culture war was what got Trump elected, or do you think that what we've been talking about in terms of the economic message of Trump is what got him elected?
I think the economic message was what got him elected, to be honest. Definitely the mass immigration stuff, too. I mean, you know, I think that's undeniable. But I was struck by, you know, because obviously I was reading reports of his rallies, and you would get the impression from the reports that all he talked about was mass immigration. And when I actually watched them, all he talks about is trade. You know, he says the build the wall thing and you know, lock her up and all this kind of stuff. But actually what he really wants to talk about almost all of the time is trade. And so I do think it's the economic stuff that got him elected. And then a lot of kind of almost like below the level of what he's actually literally saying. I think people could read, you know, the kind of masculine stuff, a sort of revival of a more tough kind of masculinity, and all that kind of stuff is in there. But the way I would look at the online culture wars is that they're almost like happening, they're the same process, but happening at a different level. So, I think they're in some way a barometer of what, you know, especially where younger people are at in their thinking. I think in terms of trying to understand, particularly, let's just say the left or the liberal side of the culture wars, I would understand what's been going on there as a kind of, you know, I mean, the right uses this term all the time, virtue signaling, but I think it's true. I mean, if you think of the early days of Twitter, in the early days of Twitter, most of the people on there were journalists or people who needed to network for their jobs. So they were kind of like networky, you know, people who wanted to influence things. And then as the sort of general public started moving on to the platform, the kind of currency was devalued in some way. People realized that if you go on and you say something kind of snarky about some conservative and then you get loads and loads of retweets, your personal brand kind of gains value while you're on there. But the more people that are on there, the more that gets kind of devalued. And everyone realized that going on and saying sort of nice liberal things was hugely valuable to your kind of personal brand and to your expansion in your social world. So I really think all the stuff we've seen going on in the culture wars, where liberals are kind of constantly purging people for being insufficiently liberal, and all that kind of calling out stuff, I view it as a kind of the currency of Twitter is virtue, basically, right? And in order to make sure that that actually has value, you have to constantly purge the people, you know, at the bottom of the kind of liberal pyramid. So somebody like Justine Sacco is an example, a sort of a human sacrifice to purifying the kind of the currency of virtue on Twitter. You know, Justine Sacco, just in case anyone doesn't know, was the woman who John Ronson wrote about in his book about public shaming. She tweeted about she did a kind of insensitive tweet about going to South Africa and getting AIDS. Now, actually, what she was trying to do was be kind of snarky and liberal and show that she gets that she has white privilege and that kind of thing. But the tone didn't quite work, right? So by the time she got off the plane in South Africa at the other end, there was somebody there to take a picture and tweet it. And she had turned into this huge public hate figure, this like random woman who had like 100 followers or something. So these kind of sacrifices that go on are all about you know, purging and purifying and making sure that the currency of virtue is not devalued on these platforms. Because people have a huge amount to gain, you know. I mean, I've seen people, utterly talentless people, make themselves into celebrities just by kind of working out the formula of how to be sufficiently kind of jaded and a bit removed from things and a bit snarky, but also show that you are really virtuous. I mean, even much more virtuous than, you know, whatever the standard is.
I was walking down the street when out the corner of my eye I saw a pretty little thing approaching me. She said, I never seen a man who looks so all alone, or could you use a little company? But if you pay the right price, your evening will be nice and you can go and send me on my way. I said, you're such a sweet young thing, why you do this to yourself? She looked at me and this is what she said. Oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money to lose this, please. We got a head to die, we got tears to cry. Please give me a sympathy. No, I won't let loose. I get my news from places like Salon. No, there ain't no rest for the trigger. Donate to my Patreon. Not even 15 minutes later, I come across a crowd.
While I do think that the main reason for Trump winning was, you know, it had its basis in material stuff, I do think that you can look at the culture wars as a barometer for kind of stuff that's happening in the mainstream as well. And, you know, so for example, one thing that Trump, at least when they're interviewed, I mean, you know, I've read tons and tons of these sort of vox pop type things and interviews with Trump supporters. And one thing they do say a lot is the stuff about political correctness. Now, that's a really hard one because, you know, when, you know, on the one hand, when somebody says they don't like political correctness, you now really don't know whether they mean I don't get to use racist terms anymore, or whether they mean, you know, whether they're referring to the fact that it's nearly impossible to say anything online without being in danger of some, you know, getting in trouble in some way. So, you know, so that's another way in which this conversation is really, really difficult to deal with. I mean, right now everyone is arguing, everyone I know is sort of arguing over Bernie gave a speech which was reported as him having said, we have to get rid of identity politics. Now, what he actually said was, you know, being a woman is not enough in and of itself to make you electable. You have to be able to, you know, to stand up to Wall Street and et cetera, et cetera. So on one level, he is saying identity politics alone is not a good basis for anything. But, you know, you see what I mean? It can be interpreted in lots of different ways, and it can definitely be used by the right or by, you know, by genuine racists, I suppose, and genuine sexists. That whole language of kind of anti-political correctness can be used in that way. So it's really difficult to know exactly what the line is between the two sometimes.